the GDPR introduces new provisions on automated decision making and profiling. But again, here, I think if you scrape the surface slightly, we've had those provisions under the previous rules. They just haven't really been effectively applied at all, simply because you've seen in many ways a lot of these digital processes. So if you think of profiling, machine learning, any kind of big data processing has kind of developed almost independently of the law. And then we're kind of trying to retrofit the law to these practices. And so there's a huge debate at the moment amongst academics in particular about what rights exactly we have in the context of automated decision making and machine learning post-GDPR.
Hello and welcome to Upvote, a tech and politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. So, since we last aired, events have been kind of weird. The Google memo, remember that? Charlottesville, Trump, nuclear war in North Korea. Have I missed anything out? Oh yeah, killer robots. Just yesterday, a bunch of luminaries from the worlds of artificial intelligence wrote to the United Nations to say we should ban autonomous weapon systems, aka killer robots. So that's a thing now. But anyway, today we're not going to talk about any of those kind of big, loud changes. Instead, we're going to talk about the other kind of change you get in politics, the sort of complicated, quiet one that creeps up on you and then maybe has changed everything before you've even noticed. Because this week, we're going to talk about the General Data Protection Regulation, or as it's more commonly known, GDPR, which is probably, as introductions go, pretty unexciting. It might not be the most enticing title, but trust me, you will want to know about this because it might be one of the most significant bits of recent legislation about this digital part of the world, which is, as we know, growing in importance. And it actually has the potential to affect every single one of us, whether that's in personal terms or at work. So, joining me today to discuss this are Orla Linsky, Assistant Professor of Law at the London School of Economics. Orla, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome.
And our friend from the other podcast that we do, Matt Burgess, staff writer at Wired, who's just published a big piece in GDPR. So, okay, right, we're going to dive into a few areas, but Matt, like, just top line, GDPR, what is it?
Short, snappy, everything you need to know about a huge piece of legislation in about 30 seconds.
Okay. Yes, please. Yes.
I can try to do that. So the GDPR is a new piece of Europe-wide legislation which covers data protection laws. It's being introduced on the 25th of May next year. It's already been passed and agreed on by everybody in Europe. That was done a couple of years ago. There's been a period for businesses to prepare for the new laws that are coming in.
Because the fact that it's quite old is why everyone's super ready for it and prepared, right?
No, not quite. So a lot of businesses have awareness of this, but there's probably a lot of businesses and people that aren't particularly aware of the laws and what are changing. But what's actually changing within this is that there's going to be a lot more obligations placed on businesses around data protection and the data of the people, data about people that they have. So their customers, other businesses, individuals, they're going to have to handle their data in slightly different ways. And for individuals, there's also a load of different rights that come into place around access to their own information and how it can be processed and how it can actually be sort of changed and what's going on there. So there's like two big areas that it's affecting. It's people and businesses, really.
Because this sounds weirdly similar to the data protection bill that was announced by the DCMS, the Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport, a couple of weeks ago, right? How can this be that they're just the same sounding things?
It does sound suspiciously similar.
Isn't that weird?
It is quite strange. I think the government published its statement of intent on data protection a couple of weeks back, and some of the kind of headline changes are in fact changes that are coming from this EU regulation, which the government is in fact obliged to implement for as long as the UK remains a member of the EU. So as of 25th of May next year, this will be a legal obligation on the UK. So what remains unclear, this looks like a bit of a rebranding exercise, but what remains unclear is whether or not the government is going to add very much to the GDPR. There are some exceptions in there that the government can benefit from, but this does look like a bit of a furore over something that we knew was on the cards anyway.
Yeah, because it was kind of announced as how in bold Brexit Britain, we, the brave British, will be able to control our own data. Hooray! But in fact, it was really just GDPR, but wrapped in a different package. Although with some some small changes, if I understand correctly.
Absolutely. A few small changes. I think the big thing from the statement of intent is that it doesn't really give us very much information. So until we get a published bill, which I think should happen over the next couple of weeks, we won't really know what exactly those changes are. But there are a few areas where you see the government intends to add. For instance, if you have a set of anonymised data and somebody recklessly or on purpose links that to somebody who's identifiable, then that could be a criminal offence. Or if somebody's tried to dodge their data protection obligations by, as an individual, you have a right to access to your information. And if somebody's trying to dodge giving you that information by changing the data, that would also then be a criminal offence. So there are these minor tweaks, but all in all, it looks very much like what we've seen coming from Europe over the past years, which another ironic twist was kind of labelled a, regulatory red tape, but now it's being heralded. So make what you will of that.
But actually, I mean, because you wrote a really great piece in response to this, also pointing out some kind of mistakes in the statement of intent and some kind of lack of clear conceptual thinking about this.
Yeah, I think that the statement of intent, what was odd was that on the one hand, it was really heralding Britain as a great place for tech startups, a great place for data protection. But there were some very kind of glaring errors in there. So something like privacy by design and by default, which is a new principle that's introduced explicitly in the GDPR. Now, you could always argue it was underpinning the law already. But this new principle is described as individuals kind of consenting to the use of their data, whereas in fact, it's just about building in data protection and privacy principles throughout the entire design process of a particular product or service. And so it's a bit odd that DCMS got some things like that that are actually defined in the regulation quite wrong.
Well, I mean, it is very complicated. So, but I guess the basic message here is that GDPR is coming to the UK. So, in a super basic way, is it possible to say, what is it going to mean, like, for me, in terms of my data in a kind of, in a personal way?
Okay, so for individuals, there is increased rights to access your own data. There are a number of different rights that are being introduced and sort of built upon in GDPR. Some of these already exist. I'm not going to go into like the specific details in terms of around them, but on a very basic level, a top line level, individuals will have the rights to be informed, to access, to rectify, the right to erasure, restrict data portability, and object to automated decision making. So those are 6, 7, 8, maybe, I can't remember how many I read out, different rights that individuals will have, and they all have different complexities. There are exceptions and exemptions to sort of some of their uses, and I think the main point about GDPR when we're talking about it is it's actually a really big piece of legislation that's very complicated, and in different circumstances lots of different things can apply. So in a slightly different position to person A to person B, there may be changes between, like, in an individual scenario. So while we are talking about it generally, that is worth pointing out that some of the stuff under the law is actually very, very complicated and will vary on a scenario by scenario basis.
So maybe to take one concrete case, what always comes up in this context is the right to be forgotten, which relates back to a court case. Was it a couple of years ago in Spain that basically you could ask Google to take down data about you, so that search results relating to your past wouldn't appear? Weirdly, that still means that they can show up on Google.com in the US, but not on Google.es or whatever it is in Spain. So this is being extended, or how does kind of GDPR relate to this, or is it actually just affirming it?
Well, here I think the important thing to note that court case caused huge newspaper headlines. But in fact, what the court was doing there was applying an existing right, which we've had in the UK in the Data Protection Act of 1998, which is a right to delete your information in certain circumstances. And so that right to delete has now been kind of relabeled a right to be forgotten in the GDPR. So what changes? So the Google Spain case, that's the case you referred to, was just applying that in a particular circumstance. But, you know, as we saw with the government statement of intent, that was kind of, there was a lot of fanfare about the introduction of this right to be forgotten. But a few things are interesting about that. First of all, as Matt has said, a lot of these rights are heavily conditioned. So it's not an absolute right. So I go to Google and say, remove my information. I think that picture is unflattering. Take it down. It's not that type of right. I know, if only, there are lots of them out there. But it's that you have to show that the processing is unlawful before you can have this right of removal. So the way in which this is being pitched is slightly misleading. That's why I think a lot of academics in particular have been quite critical of the language of the right to be forgotten. Because this is just about making data a little bit less accessible, a little bit more obscure, rather than making some, you know, it's impossible to forget somebody in the digital context. As you say, that information could be available on different domain names like google.com or using different search terms. So it's about obscuring the access to that information. Of course, you could have a big debate about whether or not, you know, that's legitimate, but it is one of the rights that's given by the regime.
And so because I guess that we all know in a vague way that there's loads of data around about us floating around all over the place. So under GDPR, will I be able to, in some sense, take... It's incredibly hard to talk about this stuff without getting saying... So I was going to say take back control or take ownership, which actually I think they're kind of quite unhelpful terms in this area. But anyway... Do what I want with this data.
So the system definitively doesn't give you ownership rights over your information, because it's a system of checks and balances where it recognises that in some circumstances there are legitimate reasons why you might need or process that data, whether that's journalists reporting a story and there'll be personal information in that story, or HMRC collecting tax and they'll need some personal data. So it doesn't give you that kind of absolute ownership right like you have over your bicycle or your car. But it does try and give you a bit more control over your information. That's actually one area where I think the GDPR is quite helpful, because already the old system tried to give you control over your information through rights like right of access to your information or the right to delete. But I think it put too much burden on individuals to exercise those rights. Whereas one thing you see in the new system is that it obviously it still gives those rights to individuals, but it also has kind of a backstop there with greater powers for the regulator on the one hand, and then more accountability for companies who are using the information on the other. So it seems to spread the burden of kind of creating a more effective system a bit more evenly than the previous system, where it wasn't necessarily very effectively enforced.
I mean, you've been working in this field for quite a while. Do you think GDPR is a good thing?
I think there are elements of it that are very welcome. So I definitely think the increased emphasis on enforcement is helpful. And I know a lot of the data protection regulators, including Elizabeth Denham here from the ICO in the UK, have said that they're not going to go in heavy and fine companies 4% of their global annual turnover. So it's going to be more carrot than stick. But I think in situations where you have transnational problems, so, you know, Google changes its privacy policy, obviously that affects the UK, but it affects other European countries at the same time. And what we had under the previous regime was this was a problem dealing with those types of issues, because there was no coordinated enforcement. Here we're going to have coordinated enforcement. So I think things like that are great. But I think, as Matt has already said, this piece of legislation builds on what we had previously, but adds additional layers of complexity. And part of me thinks that we might have been better off just sticking with more general principles and actually trying to enforce them, seeing what the snags are, litigating this a bit. OK, lawyer's paradise, obviously. But rather than trying to kind of foresee every potential stumbling block in a piece of legislation, because this is such a fast moving area that I think the more you add detail, the more complex that becomes later on.
Yeah, because there's this entire industry that seems to have sprung up out of nowhere to help you with your GDPR needs. Because I accidentally have Googled GDPR, now I just get nothing but GDPR ads on, especially on Twitter, weirdly. Maybe we should talk about the fines, because that's kind of a big area. So Matt, you spoke to Elizabeth Denham, didn't you? And like, what's been put around, basically, is that there's going to be really big fines.
Yeah, so under the law, just to put what out the position is, if people don't comply with the GDPR stuff, so that could be somebody's data is breached, there's a leak of information, they don't have like data protection officers where they're required to. And basically, if they're not complying with parts of legislation, there can be fines that are brought in. And these are sort of dealt with on a national basis. So in the UK, it will be the ICO, which is the Information Commissioner's Office, which Elizabeth Dem is the head of. And the GDPR gives regulators the ability to, in the worst cases, fine companies €20 million or 4% of their firm's global turnover, which for a lot of businesses could be a huge amount of money and would be a huge amount of money. But there's been a lot of scaremongering around this, really. There's a lot of people been saying these fines are going to be handed out as soon as the law comes into place. They're going to cripple businesses. They're going to make them bankrupt and stuff like that. But in this country, I don't think it's going to be the case. It might be different in different states where other regulators are a bit more...
Gung-ho,
yes. But in terms of the UK, Elizabeth Denham said that she's actually not going to change the way that the UK regulates data protection at the moment. So the way that they enforce data protection, sorry. So at the moment, the biggest fine that can be handed out from the ICO is £500,000. I don't think that's been done very often. It's very rare that that happens. I mean, TalkTalk, which lost loads of customer data last year, was fined, I think, £100,000, off the top of my head. So that was a big case, and that was not a huge fine. So
TalkTalk, in my understanding, they didn't handle the situation very well, did they? So that might have been a case where the ICO really piled in.
But they didn't. So, and I think that's going to be the same thing that is repeating across this. So when I was speaking to Liz, she was saying that actually the companies that have shown willing and knowledge of GDPR and tried to prepare for it, even if they have a data breach, then they're probably going to be a bit more lenient on them because they've at least tried to to comply with the data protection laws. But I think for bigger companies that are more aware of this, so for in our sphere, like the Facebooks, the Googles, things like this, they'll have teams of lawyers that have been working on this and will be complying with the law in a from the beginning, definitely, but in a way that is more, that shows more awareness than smaller companies that are startups, maybe, for instance. But I don't think that Elizabeth is going to actually hand out big fines to begin with. She said that she will if it's necessary, but it's not going to be a scaremongering. It's not going to be a case of all these companies are going to be destroyed from the beginning. It's going to be a very considered approach. I think it's probably the best way to put it.
So what's the point in having the fines in the first place?
That is an argument that a critic could make. And I think that, yeah, that it's, there is questions around whether the ICO will be strong enough on this sort of thing, but Elizabeth Denner was saying to me that she thinks that companies being fined and having data breaches, actually the biggest thing that they can lose is their reputation. So if you go back to TalkTalk, for instance, or you could say some of the really big data breaches we've seen, like MySpace in the last few years, Yahoo had lost billions of customer records. That thing does a huge impact on a company's reputation, and people, they lose trust in customers, and the monetary penalty might not hit them that hard, especially when they're a massive company. But I don't know, I think it's a case of wait to see, but also I don't know, we need to, but
because I find that quite weird about GDPR in general, is that when you talk to people who you feel like really understand it, a lot of what they're saying is we're not quite sure, we'll just have to see, which seems in some ways kind of strange about a piece of regulation. Like, don't we know? Is that just because it's quite complicated, or that it's quite new, or is that actually this is just how most regulation works in practice?
I think in this context, one of the complicating factors is the technological development. So if we just go back to that Google example that you gave earlier about the court case where Google was asked to, in certain circumstances, remove links to somebody's name if you search for them by name in Google's search engine. One of the big questions there was, in fact, whether or not Google could be kind of saddled with data protection obligations in the first place. So the rules apply to data controllers, and that's been around since the year dot, since 1995. Rules apply to data controllers, but a big open question was, okay, on its face, Google kind of falls within that definition of data controller, but there was a certain amount of skepticism about whether a court would actually ever say that, because then that means that, unlike in other areas of law, like defamation or in terms of extremist content, where Google only kind of reacts kind of reacts to knowledge of illegal content. So, you know, that kind of it's notified that there's illegal content there and then it takes it down. That meant in the data protection context, unlike these all of these other areas of law, it suddenly starts to have to be proactive about making sure that the content it's hosting is lawful. So on its face, it looks like, the rules are relatively straightforward. I hesitate to ever say straightforward, but relatively straightforward. But there is just this query about how they'll actually be applied. So, for instance, again, if you look at, as Matt was just saying, if you look at the way this has been enforced, you've got a big battle, I would say, at the moment. Now, not an explicit battle, but a big battle between the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, where Facebook is established in Ireland and should be, in my opinion, responsible for ensuring Facebook's data protection compliance. But other countries, in particular, Belgium has had a go at this, and Germany is litigating before the European Court of Justice at the moment to claim that it can also regulate Facebook, because there are different visions of how the law should be applied to companies. And so you might see the UK and Ireland preferring a kind of a smart approach to regulation, so the carrot, not the stick, coaxing companies into compliance, because they think that's more effective than whacking fines. Whereas in other countries, there's a very strong tradition of, breach, even if well-intentioned, and then you enforce. So I think you also have these very different regulatory cultures across Europe, which also then is one of the reasons why even people with a lot of knowledge of the system are saying, we're going to have to see how this plays out in practice.
And I think because the reason we've been talking a lot about companies is because a lot of this really will fall on them. Matt, you looked into that in your piece, didn't you? I mean, well, say, If you're kind of at a regular company, whatever that means, basically like a medium sized company, what will this mean for you in that case?
Yeah, so in the same way that individuals are getting more rights, a lot of these rights that people are getting, like us, for example, rely upon us going to businesses and maybe asking for data, and it's the way that these companies hold data. So there are a few new obligations placed on businesses. One of the ones that I think is particularly interesting, and again, certain caveats apply to situations and examples and what will actually happen in practice, but there is going to be mandatory breach reporting, which means that if there is an issue with customer data in some circumstances, so for example, if you go back to one of the big data breaches, if a company is hacked and loses loads of customer data, bank details, names, addresses, emails, etc., then they have to tell the regulator and also, I think, the people that were involved with this within 72 hours of them finding out. Not 72 hours of the incident happening, because most of the time, especially with cybersecurity things, companies don't actually know that they've been hacked for months, years even. But within 72 hours of finding out, they have to tell people who are involved and the businesses that and the regulators, sorry. So the issue becomes straight away to their attention. As I say, there are some examples where they don't have to tell them within 72 hours, but that is a case of it depends on a case-by-case basis. But this is actually an extension of what is previously currently in place. It just puts down the sort of the obligation in law that this has to happen pretty much straight away.
And yeah, because we covered earlier this year a really strange case where Wetherspoons deleted its entire email database sort of on purpose and proactively, and which on the face of it is a really strange thing to do, because email is a great way of marketing to people. You send them terrible emails and maybe only a tiny percentage, and they had a lot, I can't remember the exact number, but it was a lot. And, just by sending out these emails, you can get people to click on your links and come to your pub and buy things and get your special offers and everything. But they decided to delete all their email database. They had a breach before. And the speculation, I mean, they said it's because they're entering a new world of social media and kind of the respect to people's privacy. But the speculation was that this was basically saying either we're in trouble and we're worried that something we might get fined, or this is actually now just getting too complicated. It's almost too much of a risk to be bothering dealing with.
That is quite... I wasn't aware of that example, to be honest. And that's the type of situation where, yeah, there would be a big query about the motive for deleting that data, whether it's kind of to, well, retroactively try and ensure that there is no sanctions that attach to the breach, or whether that is, as you say, just looking at things in the round and saying it's not worth our while anymore to process this information. That doesn't seem to be the way the world is going, though. If you look at things, it seems that there is this push to collect and to use more and more personal information in terms of driving sales and services. Now, maybe for a company like Wetherspoons, that's not critical, but in the digital context, that is quite relevant.
Yeah, because part of me wonders if GDPR is going to have more impact on sort of medium-sized companies like Wetherspoons than it will on the really sophisticated, like the Roombas of this world. You know, Roombas that the kind of vacuum cleaner that then, and they announced recently they were thinking about selling the data they've collected on the shape of your rooms to Apple and Google. That in a way that they won't be impacted by this because they'll be able to abide by the law and use this data in the way they've always done.
Yeah, I think that's the case. An interesting thing actually is a few weeks ago, and it's been rumbling on for a while now, but DeepMind, the Google-based artificial intelligence company in this country, it struck up a deal with the NHS or a few NHS trusts last year to be eventually using some of the patient data within its AI systems to predict and sort of identify diseases. It's not quite got to that stage so far, but the work that it has done has seen it collect or receive loads of patient data. I think it's 1.6 million patient data or individuals from the hospital trusts. And this deal has been heavily scrutinized by regulators because of the privacy sort of implications around this. And I know that the original agreement was said to be unlawful in certain contexts, but actually some of the fallout from that, when Google was sort of trying to say what it'd been doing and what DeepMind had been doing, was they said that they didn't think about data protection enough when they were doing this to begin with. They were a company which is obviously backed by a massive multinational organization, but DeepMind said that they didn't actually consider patient data protection enough during this process. And I think that the hospitals that were obviously involved in this, they didn't think about it either. They were just going for innovation, for change. And if you've got a company of that scale that isn't necessarily considering this enough at this stage, it obviously shows that lots of other organisations and businesses, as we go into the time of GDPR, are going to actually fall afoul of this as well.
Yeah, I think that's quite a staggering example for so many reasons. So, you know, first of all, that DeepMind wouldn't have had the data protection policies in place. But there's also something, to my mind, quite worrying there about the idea that an NHS trust would automatically assume that the most effective or efficient partner in this context is a Google spin-off or a Google subsidiary, and not consider other healthcare providers or you know, to put this out to tender, for instance. So I think that, you know, there's a bigger question there that goes, so there are data protection issues, but there are also broader questions about the extent to which some of the tech giants are able to kind of hoover up information with that kind of falling in the gaps of our existing regulatory frameworks. And I think you see that in the context of mergers as well. So something like Facebook, WhatsApp, nobody looked at the potential privacy or data protection implications down the line from that. And I guess that's one of the reasons why GDPR should be also not looked at as a kind of panacea. There are other tech, you know, there are other data issues on the horizon that aren't necessarily captured here. I think Julia Pells from The Guardian has written some brilliant pieces on the NHS, on the NHS use of the DeepMind, DeepMind's use of the NHS data. And it just, yeah, it's a minefield.
Yeah, it really is. But it's interesting that we've mentioned artificial intelligence, because something that has come up around this. So this right to question automated decisions, and how that relates to artificial intelligence, which is the kind of the brand name for this type of this kind of computer science technique called machine learning. And one of the things about machine learning is that often you put things in one side and you get results out the other, and you don't really know what happens in the middle. And so, how does the right to question automated decisions relate to that?
So the GDPR introduces new provisions on automated decision making and profiling. But again, here, I think if you scrape the surface slightly, we've had those provisions under the previous rules. They just haven't really been effectively applied at all, simply because you've seen, in many ways, a lot of these digital processes. So if you think of profiling, machine learning, any kind of big data processing, has kind of developed almost independently of the law. And then we're kind of trying to retrofit the law to these practices. And so there's a huge debate at the moment amongst academics in particular about what rights exactly we have in the context of automated decision making and machine learning post-GDPR.
Yeah, what's the answer?
Well, I think so. Some people are arguing that if you focus on the kind of literal wording of the regulation, that in fact there is no kind of right to an explanation. But I think if you look at the provisions on the whole, and you know, you look at it, because there are various provisions relating to profiling and automated decision making, then in fact there is some sort of a right to an explanation there. And that's the way courts have been interpreting these rights in a fairly expansive way to kind of counterbalance the power of, you know, and the lack of transparency around automated decision making.
Just so I understand, when you say an explanation, like what are we talking about? Is it like, we used your data to come to a conclusion, there you go, that's your explanation? Well, or is it something kind of in more detail, like this is how our algorithm works?
So it's unclear to what extent you need to drill down into the detail. But if you think of this as, you know, a sausage making process, you know, there's the data that goes in at the beginning, which you may or may not know, but that was likely to be your personal data. So you could always access that under the current system. The end result is likely to be a decision that affects you, whether that's a decision to target me with, you know, new brands of bicycle or whatever it is, holidays abroad.
Or even kind of in some cases, why you've been not given bail in a court case. I mean, this is, I think it's more
of course you
it's
can
more
think
in,
of,
yeah. it's more a thing in the US, but actually this has happened, hasn't it, that people have said, hey, listen, why am I being given bail? And they're told that the computer has spoken. Sure. And then they can't get access to that algorithm because it's protected by intellectual property, so they don't, it's impossible for them to know why they've been, you know, they're being treated in this way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you could see this kind of being rolled out trialed at least in parts of the UK in terms of predictive policing, you know, where policing resources might need to be placed. So I was giving fairly trivial examples, but obviously this can have really significant impact for people. But the question is then for the part in the middle, so between the data going in, and I'm really simplifying here, and the end result, you know, what do you have the right to know in that middle part? And so some people would say here, well, it's just an explanation of the major factors and the weightings of those factors, but explained in a way that is comprehensible to us, you know, to your average person effectively. But there is clearly a discussion there to be had about what exactly that entails. And so others have said, well, this isn't really useful either. You know, again, this is putting too much onus on the individual, and it should really be for kind of a higher level oversight to take place here. So it's been a bit of talk about new digital regulators. For instance, in France, they're thinking of having kind of a digital economy regulator that would monitor things like this. Just kind of recognizing that for your mere mortal, it's quite hard to gauge how exactly an algorithm functions.
I think I read the other day there was talk of an ombudsman, a digital ombudsman in the UK. But I guess maybe a comparison is something like your credit score, which is just a number that's been calculated based on some information about you, but can be totally crucial in determining the entire course of your life. And it's possible to get some explanation about that, right? So that at least you can see, and maybe you can see, oh, it's because I'm this low because I'm a freelancer and I don't make the kind of regular payments that this system, you know, this system lacks, right? This is the sort of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So you might think of this as kind of, I guess, a right to act, you know, it is just part of the right to access to your information. And the whole reason why you have that right to access to your information is so that you can challenge it if it's incorrect, you know, or, you know, rectify it if it's wrong, or simply make decisions based on that information to change your behavior in particular ways. If that is, you know, I'm looked at as a health risk, well, maybe I'll minimize my butter consumption or whatever that is. So you can
it's
decide
too, it's
how
too late.
To
your Internet of Things fridge has already done it for you. But actually, yeah, but on this, but because I guess the because so much of this, there's so much noise about GDPR and how it's going to change everything and it's a revolution. But I mean, you can think it's more of an evolution, isn't it? But I guess the question is that if the previous things weren't enforced, then how, and this is just repeating them, then why will these be enforced?
Well, I think that's the big question, is will it be enforced? But I think there is more commitment there. I think it's a lot more visible as an issue now than it was previous. Even I started working in data protection around 2009. And at the time, I was going to write a PhD in it, but there were no materials, or very few. And then, you know, it's really exploded over the past years, this kind of interest in data protection. And I think so there's a lot more, many more eyes focused on it. It's been pegged as a big priority for the digital economy in Europe. And then I think that the mechanisms that have been introduced, in particular, there's a new EU agency, which is really significant, called the European Data Protection Board. And that means that when there are these cross-border disputes, which, and again, they're, you know, you're typically thinking of the digital giants, but when there are these cross-border disputes, that the lead kind of country, which is where that company is established, will kind of take the lead in drafting a decision and whatnot. So let's say Facebook, that would be Ireland. The Irish Data Protection Commission will take the lead, draft a decision. If the other companies that are countries that are affected aren't happy with that, then it goes into this dispute resolution process. And it's the board that takes the final decision. So, in fact, it can kind of trump the decision of the Irish Data Protection Commissioner there. So you're going to see a lot more top-down enforcement in those type of areas. And that's useful in those individual cases, but it also starts to, you start to build up a body of precedent here as well in a way that we haven't had before. So I think there is appetite for these rights. If you look at the right to delete, you know, vis-a-vis search engines, as it's been interpreted, that's been actually used by, you know, up on 1 million European citizens, which is quite significant for a data protection right. And it's just because it's been made accessible and visible and, you know, captured people's imaginations. So I think here part of it will be about bringing this to people's attention. Part of it will be about working with companies to get get them on board. And then also part of it will be about more severe or more effective sanctions, not necessarily in terms of the level of the fine, but just in terms of the cooperation even between data protection commissioners to make sure that if companies are dragging their heels, that there's a backstop there.
So is GDPR like a step change, or is it kind of just the beginning of the beginning in some ways?
I think for me, if you look back at the data protection laws that we've got at the moment, they all stem from EU directives in around 1995. So if you think of the world in 1995, it's completely different to how it is today. Like the likes of Facebook, Google, etc. didn't even exist. Most people probably, I can't quite remember back to what I was doing in 1995, but probably didn't have mobile phones for instance. We're creating and capturing so much more data that is personal about us and can be used by people and can be gathered by businesses now than we were then. The laws needed updating and refreshing to at least put some of these considerations into place. Where it falls into play with things like machine learning and other artificial intelligence processes and automated decisions, I think that area is still going to expand and grow, and actually some of the things in here might not be fully, not fit for purpose, but not fully up to speed with what's coming now. But actually, they'll be refreshed and case law will change this. But if we were still relying on laws from 1995, 1998 in the UK, technically, then I think that we will be struggling going forward. And these bring up to speed some of the things that have been decided as precedents, like the right to be forgotten and erasure and deleting and everything like that. They're sort of just bringing it in, codifying it in a piece of legislation that is up to date and across the whole of the EU. So for me, I think that is a good thing, but it may not be as big a, like, the sky is not falling down as much as some people would want you to think.
And Ollie, because in a way, it sounds like you'd actually prefer the kind of the full digital bill of rights, where we really know where we stand, almost like the digital constitution, rather than this you know, try and fix everything the little bits.
Well, it's not quite that. It's that I've seen the data protection, the GDPR, kind of described as the regulation of the digital environment, and I think it's useful to kind of remember what its purposes are and to not try and expand them to include things that it wasn't supposed to include, but equally to recognise that there might be gaps in there where you might have a system like the data protection rules that try and give individuals control over their information, for instance, but you might have another legal kind of system like something like the competition law rules that then allow for mergers between Google and Nest or Google and Dropcam or Facebook and WhatsApp, where those big massive mergers could do a lot more harm to individual control over personal information than, you know, all of the benefits that might accrue from the GDPR. So I think it's about looking at things a little bit more holistically, rather than just saying, well, these are the rules and, you know, these are going to solve all of our problems. It's about saying, well, what do we want? And this was something I think also that I thought was a little bit odd from the government's statement of intent, because government was really kind of getting behind this idea of individual control over personal information. But at the same time, it's been, you know, banging its other drum about ending end-to-end encryption. So I think there's no point in having a policy in data protection that pushes one way if your other policies are kind of pushing in the other. So, yeah, so it's not that I think that we need a digital constitution or a digital charter necessarily, but that we do need to think about these things a bit more broadly than pinning all of our hopes on a single piece of legislation.
Yes, broad thinking, please, if you're listening, government. Orla, thank you so much for coming in. It's been really interesting. Matt, thanks as always. We'll be back, not next week, the week after, talking about the question of platforms. What are they? Who knows? In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. I've been Roland Mountthorpe, and this has been Upvote.